Now they're rolling out a biographical video of President Obama that will set up his speech coming up soon.
We've been through a lot together. But we've known tough times before. What carries us through? And helps us endure? What are the qualities so essential to us and the leaders who have occupied this office?
He did some things knowing that they wouldn't be popular in the short run that would lay the foundation for recovery. No other country in the world would give up the capacity to manufacture cars if it had. And so he did what the government's supposed to do in a case like that.
Do not rescue the automobile industry. I mean, it was overwhelming. Look at the polling number.
A country in the midst of a financial crisis that no one really, knew the depths of the challenges that were coming. I think he had a sense.
My grandparents came out of the Depression. They knew what it was like for people not to have work. We all understand work as something more than just a paycheck. What gives you dignity? It gives you a sense of purpose.
He said, you guys got to work together and come up, and everybody's got to have some skin in the game here. You got to have a give up. You got to modernize the automobile industry.
Everybody said, it's never going to work. Well, guess what?
80,000 more people working in the car business than we did before the restructuring was passed.
They're middle class jobs. People can raise a family on a decent wage.
We've gone from an economy that was shedding jobs to one that's consistently creating jobs at all sectors. Every night, he's up until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning with his big stack of briefing books, and he reads the letters he gets from people all over America. They are, as he put it, some of the most informative pieces of material that he gets that keeps him grounded. And anyone who has kids know that the truth is, no matter what you do, your kids still think that they are the most important people in the room. So we sit around the dinner table, and he's the last person to be asked, oh, yeah, how was your day, Dad? You know, I mean, really, he's an afterthought.
He never starts a conversation by saying, what's the best political decision here? What'll help us the most? Never.
So he wasn't going to back out just because it got hard. Just because it didn't poll well. That's just never been who he is, and it's certainly not how he will ever govern this country.
When my mom got cancer, she wasn't a wealthy woman, and it pretty much drained all her resources.
Watching your mother die of something that could have been prevented, that's a tough thing to deal with.
The reason he pushed ahead, knowing that there could be horrible political consequences for him, just as there were for me, is that healthcare costs have gone up 3 times the rate of inflation. This is a huge economic issue because we spend 17.5% of our income on healthcare.
Anybody who gets medical care, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, imagine working class mom opening up that kind of bill, you know, with a, you know, somebody sending that to her with a straight face. That understanding of that kind of reality for millions of Americans drove him to make sure that this legislation got passed. It takes a conscious effort to stay connected with what's going on in people's lives.
This was a matter of principle for him. He ran on it, he said he was going to do it, and he did it.
You hire the president to make the calls when no one else can do it. He had to decide. That's one thing George Bush said that was right. The president is the decider in chief.
We were only about 50% sure that bin Laden was in that compound. but I had 100% confidence in our Navy SEALs.
I sat in that room with him when we were getting feeds on what was going on at the time. He sat there resolute, concerned, just watching. You got him? Confirm it. Just boom, boom, boom. Then came and explained to everybody the next day in the cabinet room what happened. I mean, this is a guy who, as I said, a backbone like a ramrod.
Good evening. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world.
He took the harder and the more honorable path, and the one that produced, in my opinion, the best result. When I saw what had happened, I thought to myself, I hope that's the call I would have made. It was just the right thing to do.
We have a long way to go. But with every new beginning, every homecoming, every step forward, we remember who we are.
What's really allowing this economy to heal and get us moving again is the resilience and the strength and the character of the American people. They don't quit. They don't give up. Partly because of family, partly because of a sense of community, patriotism and pride in this country, they keep going. That's the incredible gift that the American people keep giving back to me in this job.
And that was a video of President Obama's past 4 years in office, a series of looks at the hard decisions he's had to make. Now we have Michelle Obama at the podium.
Tonight, I am so thrilled and so honored and so proud to introduce the love of my life, the father of our two girls, and the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
All right, in a very tender song there as President Barack Obama walks out onto the stage in Charlotte, North Carolina, and gives his wife a hug. She was an impromptu person to introduce him here for his big speech at the convention to accept his nomination for a second term. Lots of people in the audience waving flags. The crowd is full of signs. President Barack Obama.
Thank you.
No.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Michelle, I love you so much. A few nights ago, everybody was reminded just what a lucky man I am. Malia and Sasha, we are so proud of you. And yes, you do have to go to school in the morning. And Joe Biden, thank you for being the very best vice president I could have ever hoped for, and being a strong and loyal friend. Madam Chairwoman, delegates, I accept your nomination for President of the United States. Now, the first time I addressed this convention in 2004, I was a younger man, a Senate candidate from Illinois who spoke about hope. Not blind optimism, not wishful thinking, but hope in the face of difficulty, hope in the face of uncertainty. That dogged faith in the future which has pushed this nation forward, even when the odds are great, even when the road is long. 8 years later, that hope has been tested by the cost of war, by one of the worst economic crises in history, and by political gridlock that's left us wondering whether it's still even possible to tackle the challenges of our time. I know campaigns can seem small, even silly sometimes. Trivial things become big distractions. Serious issues become sound bites. The truth gets buried under an avalanche of money and advertising. I mean, if you're sick of hearing me approve this message, believe me, so am I. But when all is said and done, when you pick up that ballot to vote, you will face the clearest choice of any time in a generation. Over the next few years, big decisions will be made in Washington on jobs, the economy, taxes and deficits, energy, education, war and peace. Decisions that will have a huge impact on our lives and on our children's lives for decades to come. And on every issue, the choice you face won't just be between two candidates or two parties. It will be a choice between two different paths for America, a choice between two fundamentally different visions for the future. Ours is a fight to restore the values that built the largest middle class and the strongest economy the world has ever known. The values my grandfather defended as a soldier in Patton's army, the values that drove my grandmother to work on a bomber assembly line while he was gone. They knew they were part of something larger, a nation that triumphed over fascism and depression, a nation where the most innovative businesses turned out the world's best products, and everyone shared in that pride and success from the corner office to the factory floor. My grandparents were given the chance to go to college, buy their own home, and fulfill the basic bargain at the heart of America's story. The promise that hard work will pay off, that responsibility will be rewarded, that everyone gets a fair shot, and everyone does their fair share, and everyone plays by the same rules from Main Street to Wall Street to Washington, D.C. And I ran for president because I saw that basic bargain slipping away. I began my career helping people in the shadow of a shuttered steel mill at a time when too many good jobs were starting to move overseas. And by 2008, we had seen nearly a decade in which families struggled with costs that kept rising, but paychecks that didn't. Folks racking up more and more debt just to make the mortgage or pay tuition, put gas in the car or food on the table. And when the house of cards collapsed in the Great Recession, millions of innocent Americans lost their jobs, their homes, their life savings, a tragedy from which we're still fighting to recover. Now, our friends down in Tampa at the Republican convention were more than happy to talk about everything they think is wrong with America, but they didn't have much to say about how they'd make it right. They want your vote, but they don't want you to know their plan. And that's because all they have to offer is the same prescriptions they've had for the last 30 years. Have a surplus? Try a tax cut. Deficit too high? Try another. Feel a cold coming on? Take two tax cuts, roll back some regulations, and call us in the morning. Now, I've cut taxes for those who need it. Middle-class families, small businesses. But I don't believe that another round of tax breaks for millionaires will bring good jobs to our shores or pay down our deficit. I don't believe that firing teachers or kicking students off financial aid will grow the economy or help us compete with the scientists and engineers coming out of China. After all we've been through, I don't believe that rolling back regulations on Wall Street will help the small businesswoman expand or the laid-off construction worker keep his home. We have been there, we've tried that, and we're not going back. We are moving forward, America. Now, I won't pretend the path I'm offering is quick or easy. I never have. You didn't elect me to tell you what you wanted to hear. You elected me to tell you the truth. And the truth is, it will take more than a few years for us to solve challenges that have built up over decades. It'll require common effort and shared responsibility, and the kind of bold, persistent experimentation that Franklin Roosevelt pursued during the only crisis worse than this one. And by the way, those of us who carry on his party's legacy should remember that not every problem can be remedied with another government program or dictate from Washington. But know this, America, our problems can be solved. Our challenges can be met. The path we offer may be harder, but it leads to a better place, and I'm asking you to choose that future. I'm asking you to rally around a set of goals for your country, goals in manufacturing, energy, education, national security, and the deficit. Real, achievable plans that will lead to new jobs, more opportunity, and rebuild this economy on a stronger foundation. That's what we can do in the next 4 years, and that is why I am running for a second term as President of the United States. We can choose a future where we export more products and outsource fewer jobs. After a decade that was defined by what we bought and borrowed, we're getting back to basics and doing what America's always done best. We are making things again. I've met workers in Detroit and Toledo who feared they'd never build another American car. And today, they can't build them fast enough because we reinvented a dying auto industry that's back on the top of the world. I've worked with business leaders who are bringing jobs back to America Not because our workers make less pay, but because we make better products. Because we work harder and smarter than anyone else. I've signed trade agreements that are helping our companies sell more goods to millions of new customers. Goods that are stamped with three proud words, made in America.
This is special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News. President Barack Obama is speaking.
And after a decade of decline, this country created over 500,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 2.5 years. And now you have a choice. We can give more tax breaks to corporations that ship jobs overseas, or we can start rewarding companies that open new plants and train new workers and create new jobs here in the United States of America. We can help big factories and small businesses double their exports. And if we choose this path, we can create 1 million new manufacturing jobs in the next 4 years. You can make that happen. You can choose that future. You can choose the path where we control more of our own energy. After 30 years of inaction, we raised fuel standards so that by the middle of the next decade, cars and trucks will go twice as far on a gallon of gas. We have doubled our use of renewable energy, and thousands of Americans have jobs today building wind turbines and long-lasting batteries. In the last year alone, we cut oil imports by 1 million barrels a day, more than any administration in recent history. And today, the United States of America is less dependent on foreign oil than at any time in the last 2 decades. So now you have a choice between a strategy that reverses this progress or one that builds on it. We've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration in the last 3 years, and we'll open more. But unlike my opponent, I will not let oil companies write this country's energy plan or endanger our coastlines or collect another $4 billion in corporate welfare from our taxpayers. We're offering a better path. We're offering a better path, a future where we keep investing in wind and solar and clean coal, where farmers and scientists harness new biofuels to power our cars and trucks, where construction workers build homes and factories that waste less energy, where we develop a 100-year supply of natural gas that's right beneath our feet. If you choose this path, we can cut our oil imports in half by 2020 and support more than 600,000 new jobs in natural gas alone. And yes, my plan will continue to reduce the carbon pollution that is heating our planet, because climate change is not a hoax. More droughts and floods and wildfires are not a joke. They are a threat to our children's future, and in this election, you can do something about it. You can choose a future where more Americans have the chance to gain the skills they need to compete, no matter how old they are or how much money they have. Education was the gateway to opportunity for me. It was the gateway for Michelle. It was the gateway for most of you. And now, more than ever, it is the gateway to a middle-class life. For the first time in a generation, nearly every state has answered our call to raise their standards for teaching and learning. Some of the worst schools in the country have made real gains in math and reading. Millions of students are paying less for college today because we finally took on a system that wasted billions of taxpayer dollars on banks and lenders. And now you have a choice. We can gut education, or we can decide that in the United States of America, no child should have her dreams deferred because of a crowded classroom or a crumbling school. No family should have to set aside a college acceptance letter because they don't have the money. No company should have to look for workers overseas because they couldn't find any with the right skills here at home. That's not our future. That is not our future. A government has a role in this, but teachers must inspire. Principals must lead. Parents must instill a thirst for learning. And students, you got to do the work. And together, I promise you, we can out-educate and out-compete any nation on earth. So help me. Help me recruit 100,000 math and science teachers within 10 years and improve early childhood education. Help give 2 million workers the chance to learn skills at their community college that will lead directly to a job. Help us work with colleges and universities to cut in half the growth of tuition costs over the next 10 years. We can meet that goal together. You can choose that future for America. That's our future. You know, in a world of new threats and new challenges, you can choose leadership that has been tested and proven. 4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq. We did. I promised to refocus on the terrorists who actually attacked us on 9/11, and we have. We've blunted the Taliban's momentum in Afghanistan, and in 2014, our longest war will be over. A new tower rises above the New York skyline. Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, and Osama bin Laden is dead. Tonight, we pay tribute to the Americans who still serve in harm's way. We are forever in debt to a generation whose sacrifice has made this country safer and more respected. We will never forget you. And so long as I'm Commander-in-Chief, we will sustain the strongest military the world has ever known. When you take off the uniform, we will serve you as well as you've served us, because no one who fights for this country should have to fight for a job or a roof over their heads or the care that they need when they come home. Around the world, we've strengthened old alliances and forged new coalitions to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. We've reasserted our power across the Pacific and stood up to China on behalf of our workers. From Burma to Libya to South Sudan, we have advanced the rights and dignity of all human beings, men and women, Christians and Muslims and Jews. But for all the progress that we've made, challenges remain. Terrorist plots must be disrupted. Europe's crisis must be contained. Our commitment to Israel's security must not waver. And neither must our pursuit of peace. The Iranian government must face a world that stays united against its nuclear ambitions. The historic change sweeping across the Arab world must be defined not by the iron fist of a dictator or the hate of extremists, but by the hopes and aspirations of ordinary people who are reaching for the same rights that we celebrate here today. So now we have a choice. My opponent and his running mate are new to foreign policy. But from all that we've seen and heard, they want to take us back to an era of blustering and blundering that cost America so dearly. After all, you don't call Russia our number one enemy, not Al-Qaeda, Russia, unless you're still stuck in a Cold War mind warp. You might not be ready for diplomacy with Beijing if you can't visit the Olympics without insulting our closest ally. My opponent said that it was tragic to end the war in Iraq. And he won't tell us how he'll end the war in Afghanistan. Well, I have, and I will. And while my opponent would spend more money on military hardware that our Joint Chiefs don't even want, I will use the money we're no longer spending on war to pay down our debt and put more people back to work, rebuilding roads and bridges and schools and runways, because after two wars that have cost us thousands of lives and over $1 trillion, it's time to do some nation building right here at home. You can choose a future where we reduce our deficit without sticking it to the middle class. Independent experts say that my plan would cut our deficit by $4 trillion. And last summer, I worked with Republicans in Congress to cut $1 billion in spending, because those of us who believe government can be a force for good should work harder than anyone to reform it so that it's leaner and more efficient and more responsive to the American people. I want to reform the tax code so that it's simple, fair, and ask the wealthiest households to pay higher taxes on incomes over $250,000. The same rate we had when Bill Clinton was president, the same rate we had when our economy created nearly 23 million new jobs, the biggest surplus in history, and a whole lot of millionaires to boot. Now, I'm still eager to reach an agreement based on the principles of my bipartisan debt commission. No party has a monopoly on wisdom. No democracy works without compromise. I want to get this done, and we can get it done. But when Governor Romney and his friends in Congress tell us we can somehow lower our deficits by spending trillions more on new tax breaks for the wealthy, well, what Bill Clinton call it? You do the arithmetic. You do the math. I refuse to go along with that. And as long as I'm president, I never will. I refuse to ask middle-class families to give up their deductions for owning a home or raising their kids just to pay for another millionaire's tax cut. I refuse to ask students to pay more for college or kick children out of Head Start programs to eliminate health insurance for millions of Americans who are poor and elderly or disabled. Also, those with the most can pay less. I'm not going along with that. And I will never turn Medicare into a voucher. No American should ever have to spend their golden years at the mercy of insurance companies. They should retire with the care and the dignity that they have earned. Yes, we will reform and strengthen Medicare for the long haul, but we'll do it by reducing the cost of health care, not by asking seniors to pay thousands of dollars more. And we will keep the promise of Social Security by taking the responsible steps to strengthen it, not by turning it over to Wall Street. This is the choice we now face. This is what the election comes down to. Over and over, we've been told by our opponents that bigger tax cuts and fewer regulations are the only way that since government can't do everything, it should do almost nothing. If you can't afford health insurance, hope that you don't get sick. If a company releases toxic pollution into the air your children breathe, well, that's the price of progress. If you can't afford to start a business or go to college, take my opponent's advice and borrow money from your parents. You know what? That's not who we are. That's not what this country's about. As Americans, we believe we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, rights that no man or government can take away. We insist on personal responsibility, and we celebrate individual initiative. We're not entitled to success. We have to earn it. We honor the strivers, the dreamers, the risk-takers, the entrepreneurs who have always been the driving force behind our free enterprise system, the greatest engine of growth and prosperity that the world's ever known. But we also believe in something called citizenship. Citizenship. A word at the very heart of our founding. A word at the very essence of our democracy. The idea that this country only works when we accept certain obligations to one another and to future generations. We believe that when a CEO pays his auto workers enough to buy the cars that they build, the whole company does better. We believe that when a family can no longer be tricked into signing a mortgage they can't afford, that family's protected, but so is the value of other people's homes. And so is the entire economy. We believe the little girl who's offered an escape from poverty by a great teacher or a grant for college could become the next Steve Jobs, or the scientist who cures cancer, or the President of the United States, and it is in our power to give her that chance. We know that churches and charities can often make more of a difference than a poverty program alone. We don't want handouts for people who refuse to help themselves, and we certainly don't want bailouts for banks that break the rules. We don't think that government can solve all of our problems, but we don't think that the government is the source of all of our problems, any more than our welfare recipients, or corporations, or unions, or immigrants, or gays, or any other group we're told to blame for our troubles. Because America, we understand that this democracy is ours. We, the people, recognize that we have responsibilities as well as rights, that our destinies are bound together, that a freedom which asks only what's in it for me, a freedom without a commitment to others, a freedom without love or charity or duty or patriotism is unworthy of our founding ideals and those who died in their defense. As citizens, we understand that America is not about what can be done for us. It's about what can be done by us, together, through the hard and frustrating but necessary work of self-government. That's what we believe. So you see, the election 4 years ago wasn't about me. It was about you. My fellow citizens, you were the change. You're the reason there's a little girl with a heart disorder in Phoenix who'll get the surgery she needs because an insurance company can't limit her coverage. You did that. You're the reason a young man in Colorado who never thought he'd be able to afford his dream of earning a medical degree is about to get that chance. You made that possible. You're the reason a young immigrant who grew up here and went to school here and pledged allegiance to our flag will no longer be deported from the only country she's ever called home. Why selfless soldiers won't be kicked out of the military because of who they are or who they love. Why thousands of families have finally been able to say to the loved ones who served us so bravely, welcome home. Welcome home. You did that. You did that. You did that. If you turn away now, if you turn away now, if you buy into the cynicism that the change we fought for is impossible, well, change will not happen. If you give up on the idea that your voice can make a difference, then other voices will fill the void. The lobbyists and special interests, the people with the $10 million checks who are trying to buy this election, and those who are trying to make it harder for you to vote. Washington politicians who want to decide who you can marry or control health care choices that women should be making for themselves. Only you can make sure that doesn't happen. Only you have the power to move us forward. You know, I recognize that times have changed since I first spoke to this convention. Times have changed, and so have I. I'm no longer just a candidate. I'm the president. And that means I know what it means to send young Americans into battle. For I've held in my arms the mothers and fathers of those who didn't return. I've shared the pain of families who've lost their homes and the frustration of workers who've lost their jobs. If the critics are right that I've made all my decisions based on polls, then I must not be very good at reading them. And while I'm very proud of what we've achieved together, I'm far more mindful of my own failings, knowing exactly what Lincoln meant when he said, "I have been driven to my knees many times by the overwhelming conviction that I had no place else to go." But as I stand here tonight, I have never been more hopeful about America. Not because I think I have all the answers, not because I'm naive about the magnitude of our challenges. I'm hopeful because of you. The young woman I met at a science fair who won national recognition for her biology research while living with her family at a homeless shelter, she gives me hope. The auto worker who won the lottery after his plant almost closed but kept coming to work every day and bought flags for his whole town and one of the cars that he built to surprise his wife, he gives me hope. The family business in War Road, Minnesota that didn't lay off a single one of their 4,000 employees when the recession hit, even when their competitors shut down dozens of plants, even when it meant the owner gave up some perks and some pay, because they understood that their biggest asset was the community and the workers who had helped build that business, they give me hope. I think about the young sailor I met at Walter Reed Hospital, still recovering from a grenade attack that would cause him to have his leg amputated above the knee. And 6 months ago, we would watch him walk into a White House dinner honoring those who served in Iraq. Tall and 20 pounds heavier, dashing in his uniform, with a big grin on his face, sturdy on his new leg. And I remember how a few months after that, I would watch him on a bicycle, racing with his fellow wounded warriors on a sparkling spring day, inspiring other heroes who had just begun the hard path he had traveled. He gives me hope. He gives me hope. I don't know what party these men and women belong to. I don't know if they'll vote for me. But I know that their spirit defines us. They remind me, in the words of Scripture, that ours is a future filled with hope. And if you share that faith with me, if you share that hope with me, I ask you tonight for your vote. If you reject the notion that this nation's promise is reserved for the few, your voice must be heard in this election. If you reject the notion that our government is forever beholden to the highest bidder, you need to stand up in this election. If you believe that new plants and factories can dot our landscape, that new energy can power our future, that new schools can provide ladders of opportunity to this nation of dreamers, if you believe in a country where everyone gets a fair shot and everyone does their fair share and everyone plays by the same rules, then I need you to vote this November. America, I never said this journey would be easy, and I won't promise that now. Yes, our path is harder, but it leads to a better place. Yes, our road is longer, but we travel it together. We don't turn back. We leave no one behind. We pull each other up. We draw strength from our victories, and we learn from our mistakes. But we keep our eyes fixed on that distant horizon, knowing that providence is with us and that we are surely blessed to be citizens of the greatest nation on earth. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless these United States.
President Barack Obama getting the loudest cheers of the evening there for his acceptance speech. He talked about how he still has hope in the face of difficulty. He said this is the clearest choice of any in a generation. He gave a bit of a civics lesson. We honor entrepreneurs, he said, but we also believe in something called citizenship. It's the essence of our democracy. He said freedom without commitment to others is not worthy of our founding ideals. President Obama is soaking in the applause on the stage in Charlotte. His wife, Michelle Obama, is there. His daughters have flown in for the evening. They started school this week, and he told them they've got to go back to school tomorrow. His family is now joining him on the stage. President Obama kissing his daughters. The confetti cannons have started to be shot off there. There's no balloons today. I'm told that's a first in modern history. They were going to have the balloons at the outdoor stadium, but they had to cancel, and planners said they didn't have time to plan a new balloon drop, so there's confetti being Actually, I guess there were just no balloons. No balloons at the outdoor stadium. That makes sense. I am tired. No balloons. There's lots of confetti, and now we have Vice President Joe Biden and his wife Jill on stage as well in Charlotte. Mr. Obama did criticize his opponent. He drew a lot of distinctions with him on foreign policy, said he's stuck in the Cold War mind warp. He laid out a list of a number of goals for his next administration. But he spent a lot of his time speaking, trying to rouse the crowd and instill in them a continued sense of hope, and saying that they were the change, and they were responsible for changes in the past 4 years. The first brother-in-law, Craig Robinson, is also on the stage in Charlotte. And lots of Bidens, lots of the Biden family. All right, I'm joined now again with NPR's Washington editor, Ron Elving. We have national political correspondent Mara Liasson, as well as E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution. And here with me in Washington is Matt Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon. Mara Liasson, let's hear from you. How did the president do?
Well, he gave, I think, a ringing and passionate speech that was designed to rally the base of his party and to rally the people inside the hall. He talked about how you've made all the change possible. It was really hope and change part two. He talked about, you know, all the changes that have happened because of what you did, that young immigrants who went to school here and pledged allegiance to the flag will no longer be deported to the country. He talked about how nobody will be kicked out of the military because of who they are or who they love. And then he talked about all the things that give him hope. And he said, if you share that hope with me, I'm asking for your vote. You know, if you're rejecting the notion that this nation's promise is reserved for the few, then your voice must be heard in this election. I thought it was a speech designed more to increase enthusiasm among his supporters and among people who've maybe wavered and been a little disappointed over the last 4 years than it was laying out a super clear roadmap for a second term. He did put out some goals about energy and education and the deficit.
He called for a million manufacturing jobs in 4 years.
Manufacturing jobs. But and he paid lip service to the Bowles-Simpson Commission. He wants to reduce the deficit. He wants to have tax reform that's fair, but mostly he wants to have higher taxes on the rich. Never turned Medicare into a voucher. He said we will strengthen and reform Medicare just by reducing the costs of health care. He didn't explain exactly how he'd do that. But he painted a very, very clear choice between him and Mitt Romney, and that's what the speech was designed to do.
Ron Elving?
This was a speech that, like all acceptance speeches, has a degree of pride and a degree of humility. But it was different from 2008. It was a different kind of pride, an older and wiser kind of pride. And it was a more convincing kind of humility. He seemed to be mindful of just how steep his challenge is and just how tough the road has been, not just for him, but for the country over the 3.5 years that he's been its leader. You know, he was mindful of those things, but he was still the exhorting and challenging Barack Obama, not radiating the sort of fresh promise that he had in 2008, but still exhorting and challenging and trying to be the inspirational speaker.
All right, we're going to dip down to the floor there. Sonari Glinton is with Senator Dick Durbin. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, Jennifer. I'm with Senator Durbin, who is the majority whip in the United States Senate. How would you grade the president's speech?
I thought it was excellent. And, of course, this is the loving crowd. They've been fired up for days now. We've got our assignment. We're going back home. We're going to reelect this president.
So what do you think is going to be necessary to take this message to the independent and undecided voters out there?
I think we focused on the middle-income families, the working families. Those are going to be the key to this thing. If they feel they've got a better chance with Barack Obama, they're going to vote for him.
But there's a lot of people in, you know, even places like Chicago and Illinois who came out the last time who don't feel as motivated this time now that they know the president.
Well, I can tell you that every president goes through this. You know, there are a lot of new voters this time who weren't here last time. So there's a lot of new blood in it as well. So it comes and goes. It's never going to be like the first date. But I can tell you, we are committed to this man. We're committed to his values. And you're going to see a lot of energy coming out of Charlotte.
All right. Thank you so much, Senator Durbin. Back to you, Jennifer.
Sonari. Thanks, Sonari. Matt Continetti, this was a man who 4 years ago was noted for winning over a fair number of independents and some Republicans. What did you make of him today?
I don't think this speech is going to convince the people that he won over 4 years ago to vote for him this time. I agree with Mara. This was a speech directed at the base of the Democratic Party, which is one reason why the reception in the hall was so enthusiastic. And it was enthusiastic. It was received. But it was stunning. I mean, listening to the speech, you would think really only two things have happened since he's been president, and that is GM and Osama bin Laden. Everything else, the 4 years that we've gone through, the bitter politics, the contests over health care, over financial regulatory reform, over the stimulus, none of this was really brought to bear. We had Clinton defend the record last night. Obama really didn't do that. Instead, he said basically what he's been saying on the campaign trail for the last almost a year now, criticizing the Republicans and fighting for higher taxes.
EJ, a striking absence of criticizing the Republicans. He actually made one reference of how he worked with House Republicans.
He did, although there were a lot of criticisms of core Republican ideas here, and in particular, he went on and on about no, he will not accept tax cuts and allow, and give up deductions for homeowners. He wouldn't cut Head Start to have more tax cuts for the rich. So there were criticisms of the Republicans, but it wasn't a partisan speech. I agree there's stuff in here in the base, but I thought there were a couple of things he was actually trying to do for swing voters. One is he asserted that government can't solve all problems. He acknowledged the work of charitable groups, and he also reiterated his support for a balanced budget. And so I think there is stuff here for middle-of-the-road independents, but he's really trying to make a big argument to them. He said this is the clearest choice in a generation. And I thought the most interesting new concept in this speech was the emphasis he put on citizenship, and that he's trying to turn government from being them, being this bad, awful thing, to being us. And he constantly redefined the role of government in terms of the role citizens play. And he actually took his achievements, including welfare, and handed them back to the voters, to the American people, and said, you allowed health care reform to happen. He told a story about someone getting health care, and you allowed these other things to happen. So there was a kind of Kennedy-esque, ask not what your country can do for you, element in this speech, which I think is new and was interesting about where he wants to take the campaign.
Mara, there was not a lot of talk of the stimulus, for example. What other things, what do you make of that, and what else was missing?
Well, I think that the president was defending his record that he's actually gotten the economy moving again, even though there's a lot of more work to do. I don't think the president has spent much time on the campaign trail at all talking about the stimulus. But what he did talk about is what the Republicans would do. He painted them as a party that just thinks tax cuts are the answer for everything, and that he is against tax cuts for the rich. I don't think he had to defend the stimulus in this speech. I think he did have to lay out a pretty clear idea of what a second Obama term would be, other than merely continuing the policies that he started in the first. And I don't know if he did that. I do think that he painted a compelling and passionate argument to stay the course. And, that's what re-election campaigns are often about.
Ron Elving, go ahead.
Jennifer, may I just echo what Amara was saying there? I was waiting on a couple of occasions in the speech to literally hear him say, stay the course. Now, of course, that was a phrase that was used by Ronald Reagan during his first term when he was having a tough midterm, and it led then to a 1984 re-election overwhelmingly. He's not in a position to fall back on that phrase the way Ronald Reagan did. Things have not been that successful. But stay the course was the phrase that kept coming to mind throughout this speech.
See, I was struck by how much he chose to outsource to Bill Clinton, if I may use that word. He didn't really talk much about the problems that exist in the economy, and he didn't really try to defend his economic record. There was an assumption here that we've basically done the right things and are on the right path, and that if you want to have the detailed defense, turn to the Clinton speech. And he was not policy heavy, but he did mention goals. And, the issues he talked about were energy, education. He mentioned global warming. Which
climate change. It was like,
yes,
Voldemort, that
change.
Which shall not be named in this campaign, but there it was.
It was named, exactly right. And then he came back to education and job training. He had some strong paragraphs on that. But I expected a little more policy specificity than there was in this speech. In some ways, I think the campaign had led us to expect that. So
all
it was
right.
Goals, but not specifics.
EJ, let me dip out of you just a second. Antonio Villaraigosa, Los Angeles mayor, is at the podium now. Let's listen in.
To the city of Charlotte and the great state of North Carolina. And everyone, for a moment, please, a special thank you to all the folks who made this convention such a success, including Governor Perdue, Mayor Fox, the host committee, the thousands of volunteers. And when you walk out and you see a volunteer, will you say thank you? Along with the police and the Secret Service, the firefighters and emergency service personnel, give them a big thank you when you walk out. Now, you've heard our speakers tell you why the Democratic Party is the party that has values that speaks to the heart and soul of our nation. You've heard our speakers tell you how the Democratic Party has the vision to keep our country moving forward. And now you've seen that the Democratic Party has the leadership that represents all Americans from every walk of life, who share our pride in our country and understand that working together, we can all achieve the American dream. Now, let us take our inspiration, everybody, our motivation, go forth and elect Democrats at every level of government. Each one of us must use the next 61 days to do all we can to re-elect Barack Obama, President of the United States, and Joe Biden, Vice President of the United States. The chair will now entertain a motion to adjourn this convention. Is there a second? All in favor, say aye. All opposed? The ayes have it, and this motion is carried. Delegates, this convention is adjourned. God bless the Democratic Party, and most importantly, God bless the United States of America.
That was Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa gaveling out the Democratic National Convention there in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're not leaving just yet. We'll be back in a moment with some more reaction and analysis and a look ahead at the last stretch of this presidential campaign. You're listening to live special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. We're coming to the end here of the Democrats' big party. We have heard from President Obama. He offered some pride over his record, some defense of it, and laid out his argument for another 4 years in office. NPR's Debbie Elliott is on the floor there in Charlotte. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm in the Florida delegation, and I'm standing with a man by the name of Michael Dames. He has a T-shirt that says, Firefighters for Obama Biden. And Mr. Dames was quite emotional during the speech tonight, weren't you, sir?
Yes, ma'am. I still believe in a dream. I still believe in hope. I still believe in change.
When President Obama said, I am no longer a candidate, I am president, this whole row where you were sitting just erupted. What did that mean to you?
It was an affirmation, you know, about the birthdays and everything, that, hey, you know, accept me, okay? I've been here 4 years. I'm doing my best, okay? Will you please, please acknowledge that I'm president of the United States, okay? It was an affirmation.
And I noticed some of the folks here said, hey, that's a newsflash for some people.
Yeah. Well, I just referenced it, you know. I've seen the posters. This birther thing, like I said, won't go away. Absolutely won't go away. I mean, what does the man have to do? You know, resurrect his moms and for them to tell him that it's probably still wouldn't believe it. Okay? So it was just an affirmation that, hey, we're moving on, and that was it. In fact, Mitt Romney brought it up, what, about a week ago. You know, at least, you know, we were born here. You know, it's just a lingering attitude, let me put it that way, that certain people just can't deal with.
What are you going
to say? Hey, deal with it. I'm president. Okay? So, no problem.
What are you going to leave this convention with?
More strength, more hope, more vigor. Okay? I really believe that I'm motivated, fired up, ready to go. But it's going to be a close election. I mean, he fired up his base. Mr. Romney has fired up his base. This voter suppression worries me. If, you know, if certain people don't come out part of the base, then we can lose this thing. That's just reality. And so, you know, I'm ready. And I'm going to fire up my friends. They're going to be ready. And, four more years.
Thank you for speaking to me.
No, thank you. God bless you. Thanks for watching me cry.
That was Michael Dames of Miami, a firefighter. And Jennifer, if you'll allow me, I have another delegate from Florida I'd like you to me speak with. Her name is Audie Sicard, and she is originally from Haiti.
I am. Yes, I am. And very proud to be a citizen and have became a delegate here. This is such a very proud moment for me. My parents came here before me, and I came after them, second generation Haitians here, Haitian Americans, and here I am as a delegate nominating the President of the United States. Where else can that happen? I'm so proud tonight. Definitely, I've always been a Democrat, but I have never felt so much pride to be a Democrat tonight, and I've seen the love and the diversity and everything else, everything that I stand for from the bottom of my heart and my soul was delivered tonight. So I'm so glad that I'm a member of the Democratic Party.
You know, one of the things the president said tonight is that, you know, I am not the candidate to apologize for, and he rattled off some things, including immigrants. This party doesn't apologize for immigrants. What did that mean to you when he said that?
To me, he meant the other party is portraying immigrants as if we were something bad, as if we came here to disrupt America, when in fact we bring a lot. We do the work that no one else will do. We strive on almost nothing to raise our families because we believe in the American dream. Everything America stands for, us immigrants, we believe in it. We don't take anything for granted. And I think President Obama gets it, how we feel about America. And that's what the other party does not understand. And when he said what you just said, say that again.
He said we don't blame different groups, including immigrants,
exactly,
for our problems in
exactly.
the country.
It used to be everything that happens when there are no jobs, it's the immigrants. When the economy goes back, it's the immigrants. We've always taken the falls for everything that goes bad. And all of a sudden now, it turns out that is not true. As a matter of fact, America needs immigrants in order to continue with what it stands for. It's a place, a country that is made by immigrants. So the more immigrants come in, the more it helps replace those people who are either getting older or who are moving up with other higher jobs and lives. So now we come up and do the bottom jobs.
Yes, I understand. Thank you for speaking with
Definitely.
Me.
Definitely. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Jennifer, back to you.
Thanks, Debbie. And we heard a lot of emotion there. The man before you said he was crying, but did acknowledge this is a very close race. The Democrats could certainly lose without a big turnout, he said. NPR's Scott Horsley, our White House correspondent, is there in Charlotte. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you.
So you're the one who gets to hear Obama all the Mr. Obama all the time. What did you make of his speech tonight?
Well, you know, Ron Elving was talking about the stay the course message he was listening for, and I think it was here, but of course it had to have some shock absorbers with it because Mr. Obama knows how rough this course we've been on has been for a lot of people. At the end of his speech, he said, "I never said this journey would be easy, but it will lead us to a better place," sort of echoing what Vice President Biden said at the end of his remarks when he said, "The journey's not over, but we're on our way," sort of a trust us, stick with us message. The other passage that really struck me is the one that EJ was talking about citizenship. And I heard this as a very pointed rebuttal to the criticism Mr. Obama has gotten over his remarks in Roanoke, Virginia. This has been the subject of a lot of Republican advertising. It was a big focus at the GOP convention last week.
Is this you didn't build that?
You didn't build that. That's the snippet that's extracted. And the president said, you know, obviously we applaud the strivers, we celebrate the strivers, we understand the role that Steve Jobs plays in building a successful company, but we also believe in something called citizenship. We also believe we have obligations to one another, and we believe that, you know, the next Steve Jobs may be a girl from a poor family who will only achieve that kind of success for all of us if she gets a hand up, and that there's a role for government to play in there. And that was he's acknowledged this week in interviews that his phrasing in Roanoke was unfortunate, but this is a real difference in worldview between the two parties, the sort of hyper individualism of today's GOP versus a more collectivist vision for the Democratic Party.
I've read a number of times that the president isn't drawing the crowds that he had 4 years ago. What kind of crowds do you see out on the road?
Well, of course, he would have had a bigger crowd tonight if he'd been outdoors. They're certainly not the 20 and 30,000 kinds of crowds, but he's been drawing 10,000 plus at recent events, especially on some of the college campuses that he's been having rallies lately. And of course, he'll be back on the campaign trail first thing tomorrow, hitting three states in the first day after he's formally accepted the nomination.
Right. And Pierre Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Matt Continenti, we've got the debates coming up. I guess 1 month from now, this week, Mitt Romney has been secluded while he practices, and we're told he's very diligent about preparing for these debates. How important do you think they're going to be?
You know, I think they're going to be fairly important. The Romney campaign's model of this election has always been 1980, which they've always thought that the public is going to wait until the very last minute to then swing to the challenger, like they did in 1980 with Carter and Reagan after those famous debates. And so I think when I look at the Real Clear Politics average of polls today, and I see that the average is tied, I think we're going to expect a close race. There's a lot more advertising to be done. Romney has outraised Obama again and is likely to spend a lot more intelligent advertising. There are also the known unknowns, right, as Donald Rumsfeld used to say. There's very likely going to be some sort of crisis that we can't predict. I guess that's an unknown unknown, whether that's an attack by Israel on Iran, whether that's the infamous Grexit, Greece leaving the European Union or European Eurozone. All these things that come into play and affect the what looks to be right now to be a very close election.
EJ, tomorrow another jobs numbers report comes out. That could also have an influence, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are three jobs reports between now and the election. The early indications are that this will not be a spectacular jobs report, to put it mildly. And you can be sure that the Romney campaign is going to try to shut down whatever momentum this convention created. And I do think it created some, even if convention bounces aren't what they used to be. Romney's going to use the number, if it's not really good, to try to shift the conversation off everything in this convention. I do want to point out two things on this speech. One is that Obama was very, very clear about drawing a big line in the sand. You will face the clearest choice of any time in a generation. It will be a choice between two different paths, two fundamentally different visions. And it is one where there's a balance between individualism and community, or one in which government is largely cast in negative terms, and it is all about and all up to the individual. And so I think he is really trying to make this a big election. One other thing struck me, which is there was no foreign policy in Mitt Romney's speech. There was actually quite a long section of this speech devoted to foreign policy, including some rather sharp critiques of Mitt Romney. And I think this may signal that this is an issue that Obama thinks could help him a bit. Everybody knows this will be an election about the economy, but everybody also knows that this will be a very close election and that Obama has a real advantage on Romney on foreign policy. And if you can shift a point or two by talking about that more, that can be a big deal in this election. And I think we saw some signal of that in this speech.
Mara Liasson, what are you looking for as we move into the end zone of this campaign?
Well, I think the jobs numbers will be important. They might blunt whatever momentum or bounce Obama got out of this convention, just as the Democratic convention was probably able to blunt whatever bounce Romney got out of his. But I think the debates are going to be crucial. They're really the only game changers left, barring the kind of extraneous events like something that could happen in Europe. And I do think the debates are going to be very important. Mitt Romney's taking them very seriously. He's been doing a tremendous amount of preparation. He's a very good debater, and he's had some recent experience, which really helps. President Obama hasn't debated for 4 years, and he's kind of out of practice. I think those are the most important things. But I do think we're in an election where there's so few people who are undecided, and we have so much money chasing those people. I don't think you're going to see big swings in the polls, but I do think what this speech tells us tonight is that this campaign feels pretty good about where it is. This was a safe speech. I think this is the kind of speech you give when you think you're ahead, especially in the swing states, and they clearly didn't feel like they had to do anything new or bold. And it's interesting, both Romney and President Obama gave safe, workmanlike speeches.
I agree with that totally, and I also think, just on the debates, I think they are hugely important this year, particularly the first debate, because Romney still has to convince a lot of Americans that he is ready to be president, and that is a big sort of step for him, and that if he can show himself the equal of President Obama or can actually score some real points on him, then he is in a substantially better position. If, on the other hand, he doesn't do well, or he doesn't look personally attractive, or Obama really sort of beats him in significant ways that stick in people's heads, then I think it'll be very hard for him to recover. So they are huge, those debates, and the first one especially.
Traditionally, the debates help the challenger by making him as big as the president. By putting him on the same stage, making them go head-to-head, it adds stature to the challenger. That could be the case again this time, even though, obviously, in terms of age and in terms of some of the respect factors that have been talked about in these two conventions, the two candidates are already roughly on the same plane.
Matt, how do you think Mitt Romney will come out of this and react, I guess?
I think he'll be, do well at the debates. It's something that Mara said made me chuckle about the Obama campaign playing it safe. I totally agree. Both campaigns did play it safe. Though Bob Woodward, in his forthcoming book, reports that the Obama 2 years ago felt so confident about their position in the midterm elections that they did not actually have John Boehner's phone number on election night 2010
to congratulate
him, right? the then incoming Speaker of the House. It makes you wonder whether someone's confidence here is misplaced, whether it's Romney or Obama. I guess we'll find out in 2 months.
Speaking of Republicans, Ron and Mara, we didn't really hear much at all about, you know, so many Americans have been in polls have been expressing frustration at the gridlock. And there's really, there was nothing about how that might change, you know?
Nothing at all. As a matter of fact, he wants to get these things done, but he didn't say how he was going to get it done in a Washington that's extremely polarized, where he hasn't been able to get over the obstructionism of the Republicans, and there are very likely to be more Republicans after November than there were before. They might have even bigger majority, possibly an actual majority in the Senate and a bigger majority in the House. So that was left unsaid, but that wasn't the point of the speech. This speech was to rally the faithful, renew the enthusiasm of people who've wavered, and get people ready for the final stretch.
Ron Elving?
You know, just before he gaveled the convention to a close, Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, who's been chairing, said, go out there and work for Democrats at every level of government. Get a Democrat in every single office. You didn't really hear that from the president tonight. You didn't hear it even from Joe Biden. You didn't hear it from very many of the partisan speakers through the convention. My guess is the polling on that doesn't look good. They don't like, that is to say, the voters don't like being told, pull a straight ticket, just elect Democrats. If we have lots of Democrats all over the place, like we did in 2009, then everything will be fine. That does not poll well. That was not the strategy they were pursuing. Yes, for the people inside the hall, they were told to go out and do that. But the televised message, the Uber message, if you will, that was to be about reelecting Barack Obama.
All right.
They didn't want to talk a lot about Congress.
All right. Well, thank you all so very much. NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving, National Political Correspondent Mara Liasson, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Brookings Institution, and Matt Continetti of The Washington Free Beacon. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
We ended the night with a rousing speech from President Barack Obama, making a passionate argument to voters about why they should trust his leadership for a second term. He said the path would not be quick and easy, but that America's problems could be solved. Now both parties have made their pitch. Next up, the debates. NPR will have full coverage of the three presidential debates and the one vice presidential debate here on NPR, along with analysis from our reporters. The first debate is Wednesday, October 3rd. This has been special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington.